Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome, everyone, to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel part of the New Books Network. Today, we are talking with Filippo Marsili about his book, Heaven is Empty, a cross-cultural approach to, quote, religion, unquote, and empire in ancient China, published by State University of New York Press. Filippo, thank you very much for agreeing to talk with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Sure, the pleasure is all ours. And I want to start things off by inviting you to talk a little bit about yourself, your intellectual trajectory, and the way you came to the study of ancient China in general and to this topic in particular.
Okay. I was born in Rome, where I grew up and did my high school and undergraduate. And actually, I wanted to study classics, you know, my own culture and civilization. And then I don't remember exactly why, for what reason, I decided that perhaps I should take a break and try to do something completely different so that I have a different perspective on my own culture, being born in Rome and so on. So I take a class on, I remember it was on classical Chinese, and it was on Zhuangzi, the philosopher of the butterfly. I loved it. We were very few students in class, so it was very easy to establish a nice connection with the teachers. And I kept on studying Chinese. Actually, I was studying Central Asia and art history. Then eventually I became a sinologist with always the idea of going back to Rome, like an intellectual. And then when I was in grad school, actually, I studied both ancient Roman history and Chinese history. So what I work on actually is not just China, is the way, as someone who was born and raised in Europe, I conceptualize and think about China, and how in the process I learn about myself. So I'm interested in particular in how the classical tradition has shaped the way we study the past in ancient China. And this reflexive approach is what I like a lot about what I do, because I always be, you know, myself, and I'm interested in seeing how I look at things, how I think about, you know, Asia or China.
Sure, and that definitely involves your approach to the comparison?
Mm-hmm. You know, saying that I don't call it's comparative in a way, but what interests me is the way we think. I'll make an example. Actually, I became interested in this project when I was working as a photographer. I was a photographer before being in academia. I started academia quite late. And actually, I was in Southwest China. I was in Yunnan. And I was a student, but I also was working on the side as a photographer. And I started to take pictures going around the villages among minorities. And suddenly I realized that as someone who was born in Rome, trained in Western art, the way in which I would frame reality, I would freeze a particular scene, was shaped by years and years spent studying the classics. For me, you know, what a human body was, how I recognized people interacting. What I had in mind was my own culture. Instead of basically knowing what I wanted to take pictures of, I was projecting my tradition, my expectation on what I was seeing. And I realized, oh, probably I'm doing this also as a student. I have some ideas, some expectations, something that I consider beautiful or meaningful, and I want to project it on the kind of China that I need to be, so and so. So going back as an academic, I started to work on the way we think. And so what we, and especially as a photographer, you know, you have always to choose what to include in a frame, what in a picture, what to exclude, and what moments, what postures are meaningful. And I like, oh, I'm doing this as a historian too. So before, you know, engaging with ancient China, I wanted to see how my background, cultural background as an academic, as a human being, influenced the way I was looking at China. Even the question I was asking, or the way I was including and excluding things that I couldn't understand. So it started, so this kind of is comparative in a way, but I'm more interested in a way we think and how it's a lot about myself as a subject who studies, how the background I had is going to influence the way I study China. And then I think that once I'm able to trace back all the conditionings, the ideas, the prejudices or expectation I have, it's easier to reconstruct, I don't know, what anthropologists call anemic vision, the point of view that is actually produced by the people I'm studying and matter for them. So this is, I call it more reflexive than comparative, because I cannot have about being Italian or having my background. And I want this background to be open and visible so that I can actually learn.
Sure, absolutely. And I think it's a reflexive move that all of us have to do at some point when we engage in comparative work. But it's not easy, right? So it takes time.
But, you know, in the process, I think I learned something. I always say, I don't know if I'm learning much more about China than what, you know, is available out there, but I'm truly learning a lot about myself or helping like me to approach, let's say, foreign subject, asking questions that help us really proceed and go on.
Sure. Right. And I think this is very visible in how you approach your main concepts, right? So religion, right? It's, and I'm using the same scare quotes as you in the book's titles, right? So that appears to be one of the most important, if not the most important concept here. And in the introduction, you provide a lengthy and very, very interesting description of your approach to religion and what it actually means, right? So I was wondering whether you could tell us how you understand this concept in relation to China and the Mediterranean world.
Okay, first of all, probably, you know, specialists know that we don't find a word that can be translated as religion in ancient Chinese texts. There are many terms referring to different rituals, different aspects of this, what we call the sacred. But this idea of religion that we keep on talking at different levels, academic and not, it is a Western idea. Not, you know, the Asia doesn't have the sacred or something similar, but the way we conceptualize it and we use it. And I don't want to become too bookish here, but you know, I'll quickly say what are the ideas that we associate with religion and I believe condition the way we study, you know, non-European realities. The first idea is that religion has a lot to do with identity, that the sacred provide us with an idea about what we are. And in ancient China, it was not like that. Religion was not a main part of identity construction. Another idea is that, especially studying ancient empires, that in order to have political unification, you need ideological unification, which is achieved usually by imposing one point of view about the sacred. And it was not so in ancient China. So one of my points is that there was the sacred, there were rituals, but the empire was possible without the unified idea of religion. And for us, this idea of religion unified is important because it's connected to European history from Constantine, Theodosius, and to the Reformation, the idea that having a common idea of the sacred helps you having shared morals. So the idea that the sacred is the foundation of morals, and it wasn't so in ancient China. Another important element that I think we keep on projecting on ancient China is that ideas about religion must be consistent, systemic, so that defining our attitude towards religion helps us understand our attitude towards other aspects of reality. It wasn't so. So in a few words, religion, like as a problematic term, because The sacred in ancient China was not necessarily connected to identity, was not exclusionary, meaning that one acted towards a particular deity didn't mean that, didn't exclude the possibility of having a relationship with other gods. So in another way, a polytheistic approach. But the difference between the multitude of spirits and ghosts that we have in ancient China with the idea we have about polytheism, that these different spirits and ghosts were never organized in a systemic pattern that represented the complexity of society. And we see in China, soon religion discourses about the sacred excluded from political discourses, and religion was more connected to the private sphere. So religion was not part of discussions about political identity, cultural identity, and so on. It was more private or local. So for me, it's important to talk about this because before I want to go back and study ancient China, I want to understand the kind of expectations and trace back their formalization and their origin in Europe and see how these ideas, questions are affecting the way we study ancient China. And also, the final question was, going back to the photography example, what do we include under the category of religion? What is part of religion? You know, in the West, we have particular ideas that not necessarily correspond to what was valuable for the ancient Chinese. So for the reason, you know, the first part of my book is about trying to understand what we have in mind when we think about religion and what we are creating or projecting onto ancient China when we study it.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. And I think it's very apparent when, you know, after doing this reflexive move, you move on to, thinking about the novelty of the empire as a form of unified government. And the way, you know, it is connected or relates to the concept of religion. And, you know, by that point in the book, and specifically in the introduction, the reflexive path is already established. So, in talking about issues of rituals and practices, you know, and their constant change, we can see how they factor into one another. My follow-up question to this is, how can we think about the rituals and the practices and or ritualistic practices in the confines of the empire, and whether we have to change the way we look at the empire to understand what's happening both in China and the Mediterranean world at that time.
Okay, so the starting point was the fact that in Europe, in the ancient Mediterranean, we had the religious cult of the emperor. There was an important factor for the unification of the Mediterranean. The fact that everyone could look at a statue of the emperor and associate it with, in a way, the sacred nature of the empire. In China, at the beginning, even as an undergraduate, I realized it was quite difficult to find the same because we don't have images of emperors. And, you know, images produced by emperors, like the Terracotta Army, for example, were supposed to be not for the living, you know?
Yeah.
So I was trying to think, you know, I was thinking if I live in the Mediterranean, in Northern Africa, or in the so-called Middle East, you know, I could look at the statue of the emperor, imagine myself as part of this commonality. But as a subject of the Chinese Empire, what would I have in mind? It was quite difficult because China was huge. The emperor, the capital, was remote. And it's clear that the connection between the center and the periphery was not as streamlined, despite, you know, the creation of a very effective system of communication was not that easy to imagine. And also another important thing that we forget when we study, you know, the unification of China under the Qin and the Han, is that China had been centuries. And it's pretty clear from those historians who start to write the history of the unified empire that the memory of the past was lost, was not clear in the early Han what kind of tradition had to be chosen in order to create a new legitimacy. And it's pretty clear that even though eventually the so-called Confucian faction would prevail, it was not obvious that the ideological choice of the first ruler of the Han would be the Confucian one. And as we know, the Confucian will create a rhetoric according to which the moral rule of the country was achieved by following the examples contained in ancient texts and actually being involved with local rituals, with spirits and ghosts, was a distraction, actually made actions less moral. So we see an idea of this sort of symbolic role of the emperor, who's an example, who rules the country from the capital and doesn't need to get involved. What I think I noted is that actually this idea was connected with a political and fiscal idea of the empire. Basically, maintaining the emperor at the center of the empire, associating him with a symbolic function, also implied that local centers of power, economic centers, didn't want the intervention of the state, of the emperor, as they were in the past. So basically, I think that especially Emperor Haudi of the early Han, he was trying to resort to pre-existing religious traditions to affirm, establish an idea of the empire that is based on the connection between the center and the periphery and the direct intervention of central power at the local level. Basically, the idea of an emperor who embodies cosmic forces, who represents military prowess, who travels and pacifies directly the country without delegating or letting intermediaries to basically be between the center of power and the periphery and the common people. So I believe that emperors in the early Han were using local tradition that would be eventually surpassed, overcome, and marginalized by the Confucian rhetoric. They were using them to establish this sort of centralizing idea of power. And there were sort of particular rituals that really depicted the emperor as over extremely powerful, a military leader who traveled and didn't need intermediaries. And I think at the beginning of the Han, since the Confucian, so-called Confucian tradition was not established yet, was easier for emperors to resort to these different traditions that came from particular areas of China. The problem is that the sources were written by intellectuals who were either hostile or, let's say, ignorant about these traditions. And so, basically, it's quite difficult to have an idea of the kind of rituals emperors were using. Now, we hear a lot that many emperors, early emperors, especially emperors that envisioned the state as very strong and centralized, as being superstitious, as being obsessed with immortality. Actually, by looking at archaeology and our sources are not canonical, it's possible to reconstruct a more coherent usage of rituals by early Han emperors. The fact that they were looking at models that would be rejected by the Confucians. Models that were for a centralized state, for fiscal control, for the centralization of all the important productive activities. And so I make the case that in a particular period of Chinese history, particular rituals from particular regions were instrumental promoting and legitimizing a form of rulership, a form of power that would be delegitimized by the Confucian. So centralized power, a strong center, and direct control of the resources and of the land. And so in my book, I try to reconstruct the fragmentary sources, the fragmentary account that we have in the hostile sources by complementing them with archaeology and excavated manuscript. And I think we can reconstruct a pretty coherent vision of what the early Han Emperor was trying to do. And we shouldn't forget that the main historian of the Han Dynasty, Sima Qian, had a very problematic relationship with the emperor whose glory was supposed to celebrate, because they had a very famous falling out, and the emperor forced the historian to castration. And of course, we can imagine that, you know, the historian was conditioned by this event.
Sure, sure. Yeah, and actually, it's very good that you mentioned it, because my next question was about your sources and the way we see from them the relationship between Sima Qian and the emperor, and, you know, how that tension, you know, can be seen or maybe influenced, and we can't see his writing or the records kept at the time, right? And, you know, it's also a matter of right point of view, right? So who's writing?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. To be more specific, my book is not about you know, a particular historical period. It is, but it's about how the sources we have are reconstructing narratives about power struggles. And the interesting thing is that I think the kind of approach I tried is that so far my colleagues were trying to make sense, often trying to make sense of local rituals, of non-canonical sources, of archaeological evidence by relying on the Shiji, the first, you know, historical record we have about that. I make the case that Sima Qian clearly was not familiar with a lot of those traditions. He was now called to describe. We shouldn't forget that the ruling house of the Han, the Liu family, came from the south, from the state of Chu, which was considered exotic and foreign by people in the central area. So in the tradition, religious tradition, the ritual traditions that were practiced by members of the Liu family did not belong to the background of Sima Qian. So I said, no, probably it's not a good idea to try and reconstruct these rituals, these sources, these artifacts we find in tombs by relying on what Sima Qian wrote. Probably we should try to do the opposite, try to make sense of the fragmentary or hostile or negative accounts that we have in Sima Qian about how these ritual practices by complementing them with what we found in tombs. And or in texts like the Huainanzi or the manuscript from Ma Wanzhui, and actually makes much more sense. And I think that the fight, the reaction against the attempts at establishing the monopolies that were carried out under Hawudi are mirrored by a lot of ritual traditions that Hawudi was trying to recover. And at the same time, the kind of debates are echoed in discourses about mythology, about literature, about the landscape, and so on. It seems pretty clear that the big thing was, do we want a big state? Do we want to give up local control over resources? Or do we accept a strong state? And I think the compromise that Hawudi was trying to achieve was, yes, we want a centralized economy, but I'll allow you know, regions, villages to maintain their cultural and religious diversity. And I will be traveling around the country, taking part in and acknowledging these different rituals, as long as they justify the kind of political vision, economic vision that I have. The thing is that after Hawudi's death, the Confucian faction prevailed. And of course, his attempts were described as incoherent, as conditioned by his folly, obsession with immortality. But I'm, you know, he reigned for more than 50 years. I doubt that he was so clueless, and especially if we consider that the only, the most important politician that worked with him, the one that basically followed him throughout his career, Hawudi was famous for getting rid of his politicians, was the one who was in charge of the economic and political reforms. So he had a plan, and was trying to justify it or legitimize it also through ritual means. It didn't work, and people who followed him completely rejected his model, even though we can reconstruct it through, you know, archaeology and so on.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So I think by now we have some sort of idea of, you know, the approach and the tensions. So how about we go into, you know, into the chapters And in chapter one, you offer a cultural history of the application of classic and Abrahamic ideas of tradition, knowledge, and morals to early Chinese realities. And then you provide a revised, you know, or alternative interpretations of notions such as religion, myth, ritual, the divine, and so on. So, you know, I was very curious about more details regarding the cultural history that you provide. And maybe also if you could give us a gist of your interpretation of these core concepts, right? So we talked about religion and myths and rituals so far, but, you know, maybe kind of positioning them into the way Chapter 1 approaches things.
So, in chapter one, first of all, as I mentioned earlier, I try to deconstruct this idea of religion as we conceive it, that especially more recently, when people say after with the end of the Cold War, after 9/11, we tend to, when we talk about the world, we like to associate like collective agency with particular ideas about the sacred. And so religion has become fundamental to make sense of the world. And I think it is a mistake in general, but it also is a mistake if we talk about pre-Christian or non-Mediterranean realities. Because, as I said, religion was not connected to identity. And also, briefly, as I say, these other elements in religion as a morality, as a foundational source for shared behavioral norms. And in Asia, religion in China was not the source of morals. Actually, it was the opposite, or the sacred. And the idea that religion must be, ideas about religion must be organized in a philosophical and legal system. The idea that every part it makes sense in the whole. And also this doesn't apply to ancient China. But then I wanted to, this is the deconstructive part of it. Then I wanted to still to find some idea that could help me in categorizing the material I had before recovering concepts that I think made sense for the authors of the sources I'm studying. And the ideas that I use, they are quite current in the world of ritual studies or contemporary studies in religion, are the ideas of myth and ritual. But myth interpreted as just narrative, a narrative about the past that is supposed to, in a way, make sense and justify norms that we adopt today, not necessarily having to do, you know, with heroes and gods, but narratives about the past that we consider foundational. And so I try to apply this category and choose those narratives that in my sources have the function, in my opinion. And then ritual, just I interpret the ritual in a very, very broad way. I could talk about hours about that, but then like going back to my usage, ritualized performances or actions that were supposed to justify the extension of the Chinese Empire in space. In other words, the narratives that I call mythological were used, or those narratives were used to make sense of the new reality of the unified polity that China represented under the Qin and the Han, vis-a-vis the past, traditions, even though they were not as in touch as we imagine with their own past. And ritual, those ceremonies that were supposed to provide a meaning, justify the way the new kind of power was occupying the land, reorganizing it and redistributing power. So, in other words, myth narratives that dealt with the relationship between power and the past, ritual, those acts or ceremony or performances that explained how the current power envisioned its relationship with space, with the country, with the landscape, with the resources. And so I divided my group in this big, sections. Then, going back to the constructive part, I realized that at least for the historian I was working on more than anyone else, Sima Qian and the Shi Ji, what we call religion, the sacred, was organized into groups. One was all those, notions about the supernatural were in a way described in the classics, and that in the end were important because not because of the object of worship, but because of the kind of behavior that they would enforce and establish among the practitioners. In other words, the so-called Confucian ritual, Li. So not important because of the object of worship, but because reestablishes, celebrates social hierarchies, notions of propriety. And according to this vision, the direct intervention of the supernatural, or the extra human, as I call it, was not important. Actually, could be even problematic. And this is something that at least the author of the books I write on considers important and fundamental to establish a moral reign, a moral kingdom. Then, according to the same author, Sima Qian, there were other kinds of rituals that were not described in the books that Confucius had chosen and promoted. They were regional. They were about which we didn't have written sources necessarily, and that all involved the direct intervention of spirits and ghosts. And of course, the intervention of spirit and ghost, according to Sima Qian, would bring into political action an element of uncertainty and confusion and probable immorality. And so I think I found out that, according to Sima Qian, ritual actions by his ruler could be assessed and appraised and judged by applying these categories. Are actions that are consistent with what is written in the books recommended by Confucius and his and the students of his tradition, or are traditions that are connected to local rituals and imply the direct intervention of spirit and ghosts? And so, in other words, in Chinese, I call them Li and Si, different categories of actions that made sense for the author of the books I was focusing on. So, in other words, these two categories are those that replaced in my narrative the categories connected to our notions of religion I was talking before. So the first part is, let's say, deconstructed. The second part is trying to recover the logic, the criteria of inclusion exclusion applied by the author of the sources I was working with.
And, you know, that also connects to the ways in which the political power is interpreted and disseminated and, you know, responded to in many ways by, you know, the people who are close to the emperor, by Sima Qian himself, but also, you know, by people who are in, you know, living and, you know, spending their days in the empire and having these rituals at hand and performing them. And that's what chapter two is trying to do in my perspective. And you do emphasize the relationship as seen in the records between ritual, text, and historical memory. And I was wondering what do these relationships look like, specifically when it comes to memory, text, and what you described as the Li, the ritual?
It's pretty clear that at least according to Sima Qian, and also quite surprising, because Sima Qian, you know, we know that according to the Confucian rhetoric, the Zhou Dynasty was the paragon, and the actions of the rulers of the Zhou Dynasty had to be used as examples by all moral rulers. But actually, Sima Qian tells us that he was going over these, you know, the fragments of the documents connected to the Zhou Dynasty, which he agreed had to be taken as models. But he said, it's difficult to make sense of them because the language is quite different from the language we use today. And even when I think I understand the context of those rituals, the object they were using, and the action that we're performing don't make any sense to me. So it's quite surprising that, you know, for Sima Qian, writing in the second, first century BCE, the Zhou didn't make too much sense and their memory and lesson was almost completely lost. For his followers, people who came after, you know, 50 years, was clear what the Zhou meant. It would become clearer and clearer as, you know, the rhetoric of the empire would be established. And so basically, I think that what Sima Qian is trying to say, and it's also problematic to establish what Sima Qian really thought, because he couldn't express himself in a very straightforward way, because the texts, you know, went through interpolation and losses, and also because we tend to interpret his historiographical approach through the so-called letter to Ren'an, and it's not clear if the letter was, you know, as an example of historical impersonation or was actually written by him. But this aside, it's pretty clear that Sima Qian says it's just it's pointless to try and recover the memory of the past and establish the particular memory of the Zhou as our model, because time, 5 centuries, and we don't understand the source. What we can do is clear that we can establish an emotional connection with these characters, with these rulers, with these ministers who had an idea of a community, had a moral idea, and we can emotionally connect with them and be influenced and inspired by their example, the difficult choices that often they had to make. And so for him, historiography is a way to establish this connection with the past and to choose those examples that can inspire us in making political choices. So for him, is this memory, emotional and moral, established with the past that, of course, goes through the literary elaboration. So it's a kind of relationship with the past that implies a very high level of education and training. So it's an elite kind of vision. Whereas what his emperor was trying to do is to establish different connections with other constituents of the country, local communities, and develop the rhetoric that basically, an emperor doesn't need intermediaries. He can directly connect with the people by rituals that make sense for everyone. And so for more than memory, for the emperor, what was important was performance, the possibility of immediately legitimizing particular actions or particular political choices that could make immediately sense for I say for the common people, but it's very difficult to understand what kind of connection there were between the emperor and the common people, even though, you know, he liked to travel and to sneak out the court. Probably often this rhetoric of popular religion was used to counter the position of the official at court that were always telling him, you know, look at the old books. Moral emperors were not that active. They stayed, you know, put, and were able to run the country by examples in other ways. They were not appropriating all the resources and demanding direct taxation. We often forget that when Liu Bang defeats, you know, after various events at the Qin and established the Han, he controlled only 1/3 of the country directly. 2/3 he gave to the old families that had been dispossessed and marginalized by the Qin. And I argue that this was the compromise that allowed, you know, the Han to last. Some areas were directly controlled, but he did not dispossess. He left things in place for those fundamental aristocratic groups that had a big role in his victory against Xiang Yu and the Qin.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And that, you know, speaks of the emperor's foresight to say so, and the way he conceived of his own power and the way he wanted to connect with, you know, what we think of common people through these, you know, rituals or through an understanding of practice. And
I want to say that, you know, I remember as an undergraduate, I got quite interested in this emperor because it's very popular, you know, because he ruled for so long. There are so many stories about him. But opinions about him can be so different. You know, he was crazy, effective. He was also almost a romantic figure. He was completely inconsistent. Then I was reading Tang Dynasty poems in which, you know, I don't remember exactly now off the top of my mind, but this poem in which he said, oh, I wish I could go back to the time of Han Wudi when even an emperor could get directly in touch, you know, with gods and goddesses. So the myth of Han Wudi as an emperor who had a direct connection with the divine, with, you know, supernatural forces and mysterious forces, survived the popular level, survived in known, you know, traditional circles. And this fascinated me. Then looking back at the sources, he was actually interested, almost obsessed with all kind of super, you know, what his contemporaries and critics call superstitions or local cults or popular religion. And I think he played that card as a way to escape or have a free hand in dealing with court politics, relying on non-canonical rituals to carve for himself some freedom at times. And also interesting that his popular cults would be recovered by even his successors whenever rulers had to deal with personal losses or personal pain or personal tragedies, as though the let's say, you know, I call it like this now, the official Confucian version of the religious role of the emperor was not enough to provide an emperor as a human being with relief, personal relief. It was too abstract. That in the end, when in crisis, emperors would resort to, you know, those kind of old rituals and superstitious things, much more powerful and effective. They were connected to, you know, regional traditions or the South or the East Coast.
Right, right. Yeah, and I think also the sacrifices, the si, are important, right, in this story. And, you know, we've been talking about the ritual, which is, you know, translated from Li. But I think the conducting of sacrifices, you know, it's worth mentioning here. And you do have a different approach to in the conceptualization of the two. So, you know, I wanted to kind of probe around and ask you to say a little bit more about, you know, the notion of sacrifice as well.
Yeah, see, so, as I mentioned, Han Wudi was particularly fond of these sacrifices that were not described in the old classics and that entailed a form of direct contact with the supernatural. Because some of the sacrifices were connected to the Yellow Emperor that Sima Qian was trying to establish as the first, let's say, cultural leader of China, completely devoid of supernatural aspects, were asked for the emperor and the so-called Fan Su, who were, you know, surrounding him at the time. The Yellow Emperor was particularly important because he achieved immortality through some alchemic practices. So there is a lot of ambiguity in the sources because, you know, again, we translate sacrifice or ritual, it's not clear we were referring to what I call Li or what I call Su. And what I see there is that Han Wudi, the emperor, was quite interested in selecting or promoting or recovering those rituals in which the emperor was not conceived as a passive recipient of tradition and example, but someone who the world needed in order to be pacifized. Someone who was able to defeat enemies of the people, was able to regulate, flatten mountains, open a path, quell demons, and whose power was connected to the power of cosmic forces. And so he liked those rituals in which these elements of the emperor who travels on his war chariot and doesn't have enemies and is in keeping with the will of the people. So for him, sacrifice often meant to establish this connection, to establish this model of the ruler. In other cases, and you know, I didn't develop a lot of that in my book, even though I probably deserved another chapter, it seemed that the emperor used religion as a way to be, religion meaning these sort of traditional, local traditions and local rituals, to escape from the court. And it's quite interesting that it's always, here and there in the sources we find his expression of his desire to be by himself and be in the woods or be somewhere else and leave behind even his family. And it's also interesting that, you know, the Tongyanshan sacrifices, there's a lot of literature about them, and we rely on Sima Qian and other sources to reconstruct the sacrifices that were supposed to be the most important point, the most meaningful point of the reign of Hawudi. But actually, it's interesting that it's not a very seldom that actually Hawudi performed these sacrifices by himself. He left everyone behind, and at the end only had a charioteer with him. And this charioteer actually was the son of the general Guo Jubin. And also, if we read the sources, we learn that the charioteer died after 3 days of the Tongyanshan. So basically, there were no witnesses. And so I don't have enough evidence to say that, but it's also for me fascinating to see religion or sacrifice for the emperor as a way to be alone, to be an individual, or to be part of the cosmos, or to be in touch with other traditions. Almost as though the emperor was trying to fight back the official role that everyone was trying to impose onto him, you know, picking from different past traditions. You know, of course, it's a literary suggestion, it's fascinating. But for me, it was something that it was worth noting in the sources, this escapist element of sacrifice. You know, there is the political one, the emperor as the ruler, as the one who keeps the country pacified and in order, but also as an individual, what times needs to, you know, get lost, as I say in the final chapter.
Yes, absolutely. I actually have a question. Four questions after this one about specifically this, but you know, it is very very rare, right, that we find and sometimes learn in school about these modes of escape, or you know, the emperor as not necessarily being under constant supervision, but as an individual, you know, or a representative of an empire of a state that goes into, you know, the wild, or goes on a trip to connect with other forces, or, you know, meet other rulers. And it is not followed by this, you know, kind of amount of people, right? So this is very rare, or at least I didn't find it in many sources. And you know, I think as we progress into chapter 3, we also find more about the hegemony of monotheism, right? That you mentioned, and you know, and it's both in Abrahamic and non-Abrahamic historiographical tradition, and you know, this kind of monotheistic view on what the morals should be and what the emperor should be, what the, you know, the god should be, most of the time determines our own readings, right? So I thought here, then specifically in chapter 3, there was a very interesting comparison that you do between fortune and the role of fortune in Polybius and the role of heaven in the records, right? And the way the emperor connects with the heaven. And, you know, I wanted to hear a little bit more about this.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you for the question, because I noticed from, you know, the first reaction to my book there was some, probably my bad, some misconception about the way I use, you know, the Abrahamic model. I'm not saying, of course, that my colleagues, you know, in all fields are implying that in ancient China we can talk about the model of religion that was Abrahamic. No, absolutely. Of course, very few of my colleagues would do that. But I notice that even though we get rid of the label, we still project onto ancient China some Abrahamic modalities. And I think like the idea that unification, political unification comes together with ideological unification, and then we have an empire, you tend to create a system of ideas that as a whole is going to help to create harmony. And I think that I argue that this idea is the fruit of our, you know, European history and contemporary history. But the idea that political unification is the result or goes hand in hand with ideological unification was not automatic, was not conceivable. And so what I try to do is let's try and look at the ancient sources without assuming this teleological model, the idea that, yes, we have political unification. It means that there is moral unification. There is that the world makes sense as a whole. And what I try to do in chapter three is to look at two historians who dealt, you know, Polybius and Samachien, who dealt with, you know, different forms of unification, that of the Mediterranean under the Romans, and that of, you know, the area that we call China today under the Qin and the Han. And what I found Samachien is that he's, you know, is the person who's looking at all books, trying to establish a new narrative of the new empire that is also in keeping with a tradition that he now considers fragmentary and almost completely lost. And he finds a lot of mention of heaven. Heaven was expected to be the last solution, the explanation of everything, you know, and whatever we're projecting onto it. And this also gives the title to my book, that Samachien realizes that heaven is there in the sources, but it's very difficult to apply these or to recognize these expectations of moral unity and coherence in the actual polity that the Qin and the Han established. This is hypocrisy, and he realizes that the unification of China was the result of expediency, was the result of shrewd behavior, was the result of backstabbing, and that at least in his own time was impossible to live up to the model that they found in the sources. And what I noticed that at least Sima Qian and the books that deal with the unification of China, especially the biography of Liu Bang, the first emperor of the Han, whenever he mentions heaven, is always ironic. It's never to define what heaven is, but also hope. We don't understand, it's problematic, oh, must be heaven. And all, you know, many circumstances in which he uses heaven is really ironic. When there is something that is clearly confused, immoral, surprising, counterintuitive, you say, oh, must be heaven. You know, often it's been his famous sentence, you know, is when he says, you know, it's so strange that someone who was born in a, you know, in an almost godforsaken area, a poor guy from someone who no land managed to become the emperor of China. Must be heaven, he said. No, must be heaven. And then if we read the Suji, which is a huge work, very complex, we realize that for Sima Qian, heaven meant chance, expediency, and hypocrisy. And also, in the famous sentence, you know, someone who no land, who becomes the emperor, I focused on the no land. And I argue that probably Liu Bang was chosen as the leader of the alliance of aristocrats, because he was the only one among them who didn't have his own aristocratic background and his own land. So basically could be the leader of a coalition and would be less problematic because no one would see him as an aristocrat. And so would be the perfect leader for that compromise between a state that centralizes but also leaves aristocratic lineages with the privileges they had before. And I think Sima Qian had understood that. So he's continuously talking about the emptiness of Liu Bang as a leader, who just would repeat, parrot, whatever his associate would tell him to say about the reasons why he was an emperor. So I think Sima Qian is brilliant in understanding that, of course, he had to play his role of official historian, but he found himself with an established tradition to a certain extent, even though it was clear to him that it was not obvious to interpret it. And he uses heaven in an ambiguous way, on the one hand referring to the moral connection between political power and universal morals that we find in a certain way in the ancient sources, but also pointing at the hypocrisy, the violence that had brought China to become one. So, I argue, going back to the comparative or cross-cultural model, that because of our expectation of unity, kept on projecting onto Sima Qian's notion of heaven all these expectations of ideological, cultural, and moral unification that Sima Qian himself did not see, just projecting onto it. For him, heaven was in the end sort of a rhetorical residue of an ancient mission who didn't make too much sense at the time. And he uses it because it's there and it's powerful.
Right, and then he also, makes use of memory, right, or what he kind of remembers.
And as I said, for him, it was clear that emotionally it was possible to be influenced, inspired by historical characters who had particular qualities. And he envisions his work as that of resuscitating in a way or making available these examples through, the literary means. Some scholars argued that since he was a eunuch and he couldn't carry out, ancestral sacrifices personally, to maintain the connection between the living and the dead of his family, ritually was incapable of doing it because of his castration, the literary means was the only one he could use to maintain the connection between his ancestor, real ancestor, cultural ancestor, and the future generations. So in a way, his work replaces the rituals the good Chinese would carry out to maintain the connection between the living and the dead. It's a very fascinating interpretation. And I think in part it's true.
Right. I mean, it is very fascinating. And, at least in the European tradition, writing, and I'm sure all over the world, but, I'm just more familiar with that. Writing, having written poetry or having written different works of literature will maintain or maybe assure immortality, right? So
it seems a concern of Sima Qian, ritually and culturally. Another interesting thing is about the function of the historian when analyzing China is that what we call historians in ancient China, in addition to recording the past, they also had to record the heavens, what happens in the sky, all kinds of phenomena. So the relationship was just recording events in the past and in the present. And it is the idea that there was a connection and the past could teach us how to behave in the present, because actually what happened, circumstances of the past, could reproduce themselves. And so the circularity of the experience, not only from an intellectual point of view, because, by recovering the past, the past is always present, but also because in the end, the canvas where we are acting, the cosmos, works according to the same rules, and what worked in the past could be working today. So this idea of using the past to project and shape the future in a way that is, I think, a feature of Chinese historiography.
Sure, absolutely. And I think, in the past being used as a heuristic to understand the present and the future is also apparent in models of rulership, right? And in Chapter 4, you do engage with the notions, of time, myths, and memory. But more importantly, this interpretation of the importance of the Yellow Emperor as a model of rulership, right? So you do have three different approaches to this and how they impacted the rulership of Emperor Wu. So, you know, I thought that was a key moment in chapter four that pushed your argument further.
Sorry, I didn't hear the last part of your question.
Oh, I was just asking about the three different interpretations of the importance of the Yellow Emperor as a model of rulership for Emperor Wu.
Oh, yes. Yes, I argued that, you know, it seems that in that period, the Yellow Emperor was quite hot. You know, everyone was talking about him. And there are a lot of debates and literary disquisitions about, you know, who was the Yellow Emperor and what kind of rulership, what kind of power he represented. And for me, it's quite important that the Yellow Emperor is the protagonist of chapter one of the Sijil, the work of Sima Jian, and is the first ruler. It's quite interesting because the narrative that Sima Jian creates about the Yellow Emperor is not confirmed or is not similar to anything else we find in that period. The Yellow Emperor was, you know, as I said, there was associated with immortality, was connected to cosmic forces, was a warrior, was an alchemist, would be eventually associated, you know, with the medicine, the body. And I argue that as an author, as a writer, Sima Jian and his father were probably in writing the biography of this Yellow Emperor, who in the chapter written by Sima Jian doesn't have any supernatural powers. They are not important, and he's not immortal. He dies, and he has his tomb, and so on. Was attempt establishing a good model for that eventually a good Han ruler would follow. And so he, in a way, was adding out from the model he created all those elements that would connect the Yellow Emperor to spirits and ghosts, to the invisible forces. Those kind of elements that, according to Sima Jian, would bring into political action uncertainty and probably immorality. So, in the chapter, I analyze how the literary debates becomes the stage in which different notions of power are debated and compared. Whereas, on the other hand, we have the Sima Jian trying to follow all these stories about the Yellow Emperor that were told by, you know, this alchemist Fang Shi, coming from, you know, remote regions of barbarians that of course, Sima Jian condemns. But in addition to the element of immortality, that again, you know, might be seen as an escapist element, anti-family element. And when we see anti-family rhetoric in Hawu Di, my opinion, it's just anti-family as such. It's anti-particular aristocratic families. There were claiming particular privileges, fiscal privileges, connected to the attempts of the empire to tax them, you know, to expropriate their, you know, the monopoly they had on production of coins, salt, and iron. So, if the myth of the Yellow Emperor as a champion of immortality, on the one hand, yes, is escapist, is individualist, but it's also anti-particular aristocratic position that was in that particular period reacting against the attempts of Hamadi's government to establish state monopolies and centralize everything. We forgot that Hamadi would be the first emperor after Liu Bang to really establish the Zhongxian control, the direct control of the state over all China. Basically, breaking down, removing all the heirs or those families that have been fundamental for the revolution that eventually gave power to the Liu family and Liu Bang. So when we hear anti-family rhetoric in Hawu Di, I will be always conscious. It's not just abstract families or, you know, a particular anti-aristocratic, not in general, those particular families that didn't want the state to be so intrusive.
Absolutely, yeah, and you know, I mean, it's quite obvious why they were so against the state being so intrusive. But on the other hand, right, so the emperor had issues of legitimization, you know, in mind, probably, or, you know, the whole idea of legitimization of the Han, right, in terms of...
This term is pretty, I think, it's pretty easy to understand. You know, at the time, they didn't have media. So they had the literary medium that was used by the courtiers, the people around the capital, people. And then they had ritual. And so notions about political models or attitudes were just played in that stage, the ritual one or the literary one. And these are, you know, conflated. And I see, you know, the mythological narrative one and the ritual performative one. That are all used by different actors, you know, in different ways. What I try to do in my book is that, you know, I never talk about myth or religion in abstract. Whenever I talk about a particular myth, I try to refer it to particular sources written in particular period and connect them with particular political and economic context so that those kind of metaphor that we're using can be translated in a particular cultural context. Because, you know, the problem with people like me who study religion is that it's so easy to use it in a sort of meta-historical way. So these ideas or notions, even provisionally, as universal. What I'm trying to do as a rule is always try to reconnect them to particular cultural and economic and political context. So I never talk about these things in abstract. So when I talk about models of rulership, in particular rituals, I just talk about, in the end, like 20 years and the kind of literary exchanges or ritual exchanges that are happening in that period, studying together economic reforms, clashes between the state and provincial elites, and how these were reflected in myth and ritual reform that were happening in those few years.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think by doing that, you also avoid the... you know, mental slippage that sometimes we all, you know, have with using categories across temporal categories or even going meta a little bit.
Yeah. And especially if one reads, you know, the title of my book, and I want it to be anachronistic on purpose, not using a sort of Buddhist sentence too, because I mean, those things exist and influence the way we think and ask questions and create criteria of exclusion and inclusion when we think and study. So I wanted to, the first half of my book, I want to be as explicit as I could about all the conditionings, the prejudices, the expectations I had if someone was trained as a classicist, you know, a photographer in Rome. And I think, you know, probably there are mistakes in my book and things will be updated and surpassed, overcome. But I think that what I could contribute with was, you know, being open about the kind of motivations and the questions that led my research, you know, and try to put them at the forefront so that I could eventually, in the more honest possible way, go back and recover an original emic native perspective on those issues, trying to, you know, with their own words, to the extent to which that is possible, which is not.
Certainly. Yes. And, you know, besides what we've talked in the past few minutes, chapter 5, right, also drives home this idea or the tension between what you call a religion for the emperor and an imperial religion. And, you know, this is this goes throughout the book, but, you know, chapter 5 and the conclusions draw it home. So, you know, I wanted to ask you tell our listeners more about it.
Thank you for this. You know, it makes me think of the reaction I often have when I go, you know, give talks around the world, and especially in China. Even though I'm explicit about that, and I say I anticipate the kind of pushback I can receive for saying what I say, but nonetheless, I have this reaction often. What do you mean? No, there is no imperial religion. What do you mean? The ancient Chinese didn't have a religion, which is often seen as offensive to the extent to which it's seen as having no religion means having no morals.
Right.
Say, how about you say your heaven is empty? The emperor didn't have a religion. The emperor was always practicing, you know, sacrifices. Going, this is true. I said, but that was his own religion. If anyone else tried to emulate, to ape the emperor and carry out the same kind of to worship heaven, would be beheaded immediately. It's quite interesting that in, to me, that you know, the term religion, Zongjiao, arrives in China at the end of the 19th century as a translation of the Japanese term Shukyo, who in turn had taken their invented this term for the translation of the German and English term. And the interesting thing that the Meiji reformers of Japan, when they want to transform Japan in a few years, they look at the West. And then look at, you know, we have letters written by all the secretaries who went around the world with the Japanese leaders observing Western, you know, institutions, societies, and so on. And I remember this and it really struck me about someone observing Christianity in the U.S. And they were saying, all these people, you know, worshiping this guy who was a criminal, you know, it's not respectful. I don't understand why, you know, Christianity can be so important. But something that's really important to us is that it doesn't matter who you are. You can be the president of the country. You can be an aristocrat. You can be really educated. You can be a farmer. They all worship the same God. They all carry out the same ritual. They all together. And this thing shapes the way they are. And since they're one as a nation, it's easy to carry out swift reforms. We should apply something like that. And eventually they created, you know, the divinized emperor, and the cult of the emperor in Japan was fundamental for the reform that would transform Japan in a very short time. And after, you know, the end of the First Sino-Japanese War, Qing Dynasty reformers were looking at Japan as an example. How come that they were able to carry out reforms so quickly? Because they found this unity around this sacred nature of the emperor. Probably the Chinese of the time said, we should do something very similar. And of course, in Chinese style, they said, yes, but we might have had this already. Probably we had a state religion in the past. They looked back at the Easter Han historiography, and they found Dong Junshu and the idea of a Han religion. And of course, they worked on that. But my point is that, of course, the emperor had his own rituals, but religion was not conceived, the kind of ritual, as working on a shared background of morals, as creating the moral unification between the subjects and the rulers. It's something that we connect, that is natural for us, I mean, us Europeans, because of the history of the Christian Roman Empire and the history of Christianity in Europe. But the idea that the sacred, the supernatural, the invisible can be used to create shared morals and have a country on the same page is not universal and has a particular history in the West. So going back to your question, to the, you know, the religion of the emperor and the religion of the empire, under Rome and especially at the end of the Roman Empire, yes, we have an imperial religion, which was instrumental in the creation of a community. In China today, the sacred is never used. I mean, actually now it's changing a little bit with the revival of Confucianism as a world religion. It's another question. But in Asia, it's not that automatic or natural to use the sacred and visible as a common ground on which to establish common institutions and traditions. So yes, the emperor had a religion, but was not a religion that shared with his subjects. Who would be beheaded immediately if they dared.
Sure, absolutely.
To worship heaven, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's all very, very fascinating to think about these things. But, you know, I'm afraid we've taken a lot of your time. So
no,
my But, you know, my last question regards your next projects. So what are you working on at the moment?
Oh, okay. So, yeah, I spent years, you know, working on the relationship between, you know, invisible things, invisible entities, also invisible things like ideas, concepts, frameworks. And then I said, I want to do something completely, you know, I cannot say refreshing considering the topic, but I want to look at something completely different. So I'm now looking at the relationship between power and the body, punishment. How I'm looking at both the narrative of political power in connection with justice and punishing illegal destructive behavior.
Fascinating.
So my current project is on the relation between violence and power, especially when looking at torture and imprisonment, and also in slavery. Now, exactly, I'm looking at mythological, of course, you know, as my I'm used to doing that. Also, continuation of my previous work, how in mythology, in ancient myth, the necessity of having laws was justified in literary and historical sources. And then I'm comparing the actual application of law in ancient China, we can do it because we have a lot of scattered manuscript now, to the way laws were described in of course, in the legal text, but especially in historiography. So this kind of narrative about this justification of rulers who, in addition to being moral paragons, also have to enforce some punishment. So how that is...
very interesting. That is very, very fascinating. And, you know, I'm looking forward to reading your next books and articles.
Thank you so much.
I thank you very much for talking with us today.
It was a pleasure, and I wish you a wonderful day or evening.
Thank you so much, Filippo.
Thank you.